Kidd, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Robert Kidd on behalf of the Appalachian State of Ohio. May it please the court. Your Honors, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through the procedural history or the factual background of this case. This case has been litigated so many times. It's been litigated throughout most of my natural porn life. But I did want to direct my argument specifically to a few issues brought up in Appellant's brief. I'll start off with specifically with issue one. When we're talking about a trial court denying a motion for a new trial, this court has routinely held that court's going to be giving a large amount of discretion. And in fact, it would be the appellant's duty today to prove, to clearly prove, that the trial court did abuse its discretion when it made its denial. An abuse of discretion is not a mere error of law. It's an attitude or decision that suggests that the court is being unreasonable, arbitrary, or unconscionable. And in this case, Your Honor, respectfully, that doesn't exist. Looking at Criminal Rule 33A6, and more importantly, State v. Petro, the Ohio Supreme Court made specific rules and prongs for when deciding whether or not a new trial, or whether or not it's appropriate to grant a new trial based on discovery of new evidence. Looking at State v. Petro, there are six prongs coming out of that court, that decision rather, specifically referring to prongs 2, 3, 5, and 6. I want to save the issues of materiality for issue 2, but for prong number 3, that the evidence or the discovered evidence had not been able to be discovered before the trial, even through the exercise of due diligence on behalf of defense counsel, that's really where the trial court rendered its decision, in my opinion, to deny the motion for new trial. It appeared to me that the trial court was convinced that because Ms. Yezzo was available for cross-examination, that this evidence could have easily been discovered had trial counsel at that time on behalf of the defense had simply asked if she had ever been disciplined or simply asked if she had ever received any sort of, there had ever been any allegations made that she was not performing her duty or job at the best of her duties. And that's really what.
Do we know from the record how long this? They're alluding to some kind of an ongoing investigative process that was turning up, at the very least, opinions from coworkers that were being noted and collected apparently and passed around within the agency. Do we know how long that had been going on by the time of her testimony? Prior to her testimony, I mean, for a year before or for a few months before, does the evidence indicate?
Respectfully, Your Honor, you know, when looking back at the evidence, it looks like there's a period of several months where at least there are letters exchanged between departments. But, you know, more importantly, when the actual internal affairs investigation took place, all we have as a record of that internal affairs investigation appears to be handwritten notes. I don't recall there being any sort of date frames of when those interviews were taking place. So to answer your question, we know that there was at least some period of time. We don't know exactly how long these allegations or rumors rather were beginning to surface within BCI regarding
this. Is it accurate to say that whatever was going on had not had any form of adjudication, even a probable cause adjudication, or any formal action of any kind or conclusory action had been taken? Is it accurate to say that, or had there been some preliminary finding on the part of the internal agency that had led to further investigation or something like that? Do we know from the record?
From the evidence itself, Your Honor, I can't say for certain that there was ever any sort of adjudicatory hearing or anything like that. What I can say for certain is that based upon the internal affairs investigation, she was never placed under any sort of suspension. There was no meaningful punishment rendered by that internal affairs.
They just said she was on leave or something, or on suspension pending this investigation. So there must have been some kind of preliminary finding. Now, maybe that's totally routine, and maybe it would be improper to assign any qualitative value to that.
Correct. I believe she was.
But at the same time, there must have been something. They indicated she was actually placed on leave. The record indicates that she was placed on leave.
Right. I think during
the course of that. For this particular purpose.
Right. During the course of the actual investigation, when it was turned over to Internal Affairs, she was placed on leave for that period of time. But she was then reinstated fully, what I think that what amounted to essentially a verbal reprimand.
This verbal reprimand, so this thing, the evidence does show this was brought to some kind of conclusion?
Right.
Was that prior to her testifying at the trial?
I believe the conclusion was after she testified at trial.
Well, assuming that there's a vehicle under which somehow this would be appropriate to introduce into a trial about any expert presented by the defense or the state or anybody else, what's your response to the position that regardless of what the prosecutor or the office of the prosecutor actually knew, DCI apparently knew about this, and that it had some impact on her credibility, and that should all be imputed to the office of the prosecuting attorney, and something that should be, therefore, should have been disclosed.
Well, respectfully.
If nothing else, I mean, DCI should have disclosed it to the office of the prosecutor, and from the defense point of view, it's all the state, and so whether the prosecutor negligently failed to disclose it or DCI negligently failed to disclose it to the prosecutor, you've got something involving an expert witness and testifying in what at that time was a capital death penalty case, and therefore there was an obligation somewhere within the state bureaucracy to have disclosed this, and the defense ought to get the benefit as to, and not have to nitpick over which particular agency it was. It's all imputed to the state, and it resulted in them not having information that perhaps they should have at the time of trial. What's your response to that?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think if you take the allegations themselves and you put them in a vacuum, I mean, certainly that's impeachable evidence. That's evidence that I fully expect the defense to try to bring up at trial to try to damage the credibility.
Do you feel that it's impeachable evidence that there's an ongoing investigation which has not reached any conclusion yet, but which has opinions of a variety of coworkers, and nothing further to indicate the validity of those opinions or whether they're corroborated or supported by actual evidence or anything? Are you conceding that you feel that nevertheless would be admissible as impeachable evidence?
Respectfully, no. What I'm trying to suggest is that if you look at it just the allegations themselves in a vacuum, forget everything else, then that, assuming those allegations are true, that would be impeachable evidence. Now, again,
that a defense attorney or a prosecutor, if this were a defense expert, would be entitled to say, now, isn't it true that there's some kind of an ongoing investigation into your behavior? Isn't it true that co-worker John Doe here said this about you? And isn't it true that co-worker Jane Doe said that about you? And that's what you're indicating when you say it's impeachable. I mean, how else is it going to be introduced? It's going to be introduced by opposing counsel.
Right.
Cross-examining the expert about things that co-workers have said about them. So before we know whether there's anything to support what the co-workers have said about them, so is it your position that is legitimate impeachment evidence?
Your Honor, what I'm trying to say is, you know, if we start to factor in everything else that's taken place since the time of the allegations were made, we know that as far as a punishment was concerned, you know, there really wasn't much of any punishment. We know that as of right now, there's some serious issues as far as admissibility. If a new trial were granted today, I'm not sure how this evidence would even come forth in a trial. We've got issues of hearsay. We've got issues of hearsay within hearsay. We have handwritten notes that we have no idea who actually authored these notes. So there's issues with authentication. There's issues with opinion testimony. If we're talking about a prior bad acts or reputation testimony, there's certain amount of the rules of evidence in some instances would prevent the exploration of that in cross-examination.
Do you have any authority bearing on the issue about the imputing that I was asking earlier, the fact that this may have been ongoing at the BCI level should or should not be attributed to the prosecution in a case like this in terms of constructive knowledge or constructive responsibility for disclosing this? Is there any authority that you're aware of that would direct us on that particular issue?
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, I know that there's cases cited in an appellant's brief. I can't remember those case names specifically off the top of my head. I'd be happy to review that and get back to you. But again, you know, the real issue is getting back to the State v. Petro. If what we are talking about is merely impeachment evidence, State v. Petro clearly says, and again, State v. Lopa back in 1917 clearly says that defendants or appellants trying to seek a new trial based solely on impeachment or cumulative evidence, that's not good enough. The Ohio Supreme Court understood that no judgment would be safe if we would allow defendants to continuously reopen cases when we find new information that could be used for impeachment purposes. And that's why, again, going to issue one, specifically prong six of State v. Petro, it's pretty clear that the law would prevent this type of trial being reopened, specifically based solely on impeachment evidence. As for the second issue of materiality, again, Your Honor, like I was saying, if you look at the allegations just simply in a vacuum, then certainly that would lend some strength to the defense's or the appellant's argument. However, they're simply ignoring the rest of the evidence at trial. We have not one but two eyewitnesses that testified at trial that appellant is the one who carried out these heinous acts. We have ballistic evidence that would show that there was just one, all the casings were coming from one firearm, the casings that were found just outside of the General Electric plant that matched the casings that were found at the scene of the crime, and we knew that the appellant was there to pick up his girlfriend at the General Electric plant. There was an exorbitant amount of evidence that this court has upheld as being overwhelming and evidence of beyond a reasonable doubt, that the Ohio Supreme Court has found to be overwhelming and evidence of beyond a reasonable doubt, that the federal courts have done the same. We've had, this case has been litigated so many times that this decision rendered by these 12 jurors have withstood the test of time. That looking at the case law of U.S. v. Augers, when we're talking about material evidence that might help the defense at trial, that doesn't rise to the level of materiality in a constitutional sense. So certainly, appellant can say, yeah, this could have helped me at defense at trial. It could have impacted the credibility of Ms. Yezzo, and it could have possibly helped me. But there's absolutely nothing that says that there's a reasonable certainty we would have had a different verdict had this evidence been made available to the defense at the time of trial. And because we don't have that probability, a reasonable probability that we could have a different verdict, Your Honors, I would suggest that means that this evidence itself is not material. And therefore, if it's not material, it doesn't pass the test in State v. Petro. It doesn't pass the test in Brady v. Maryland. We don't have an issue of that's at least in the eyes of the law would grant a new trial in this case.
Can you tell me where Ms. Yezzo's deposition was taken? The physical location of that?
The physical location of that?
Was it at BCI? Was it at the courthouse? Was it at some law office? Do you know?
I don't know that, to be honest with you. And finally, Your Honor, as far as issue three, again, looking at Rule 33B, applying the plain language there, it's entirely appropriate for a trial court to at least strike from the record It was entirely appropriate for this trial court to at least strike from the record for the time being until it had rendered a decision as whether or not to grant the motion for leave for new trial. 33B specifically states that a motion for a new trial shall be filed within 7 days from an order of the court finding that he was unavoidably prevented from discovering the evidence within the 120-day period. As such, Your Honors, I would suggest that there's no. I see that I've run out of time, Your Honors. Thank you very much for your time today.